Today's scripture text is Ezekiel 40 through 42. No, we're not reading all of every chapter. But I do have a slight fear, perhaps as parents who know certain situations their kids often do poorly in, and so before you enter that situation, you give them the pregame about how you really want them to behave. I feel like I need to do that with all of you today to a degree. Not because you've been behaving poorly in the past, but this passage, let's be honest, is really difficult. Seems like it's a complete waste of ink, even to some commentators, sadly. Often many of them chalk this up to just scriptures that are worse than the most worthless genealogies. Others chalk it up to Ezekiel, the former priest, just nerding out here at a bunch of temple archaeology, and that, well, if he's excited about it, we should let him have his fun. And there is great, great comfort, I promise you, to be had from these verses. But it will take you perhaps being on your best behavior and not just zoning out. So we're going to jump around here a little bit. I'm going to read chapter 40, verses 1 through 4. Then we're going to jump to 41, 13 to 26. Then we're going to read 42, verse 1, and then jump to 42, 13 through 20. I'll be announcing where we're going as we read. Don't worry. So with that in mind, and your best behavior, hear now the word of the Lord. Ezekiel chapter 40. In the 25th year of our exile, at the beginning of the year, on the 10th day of the month, in the 14th year after the city was struck down, on that very day, the hand of the Lord was upon me, and he brought me to the city. In visions of God, he brought me to the land of Israel and set me down on a very high mountain, on which was a structure like a city to the south. When he brought me there, behold, there was a man whose appearance was like bronze, with a linen cord and a measuring reed in his hand. And he was standing in the gateway. And the man said to me, Son of man, look with your eyes and hear with your ears, and set your heart upon all that I shall show you. For you were brought here in order that I might show it to you. Declare all that you see to the house of Israel. Jump ahead to chapter 41, verse 13. Then he measured the temple, 100 cubits long, and the yard, and the building with its walls, 100 cubits long. Also the breadth of the east front of the temple and the yard, 100 cubits. Then he measured the length of the building facing the yard, and that was at the back and its galleries on either side, 100 cubits. Inside of the nave and the vestibules of the court, the thresholds and the narrow windows and the galleries all around, the three of them, opposite the threshold, were paneled with wood all around, from the floor up to the windows. Now the windows were covered. To the space above the door, even to the inner room, and on the outside, and all the walls all around, inside and outside, was a measured pattern. It was carved of cherubim and palm trees, a palm tree between each cherub and cherub. Every cherub had two faces, a human face toward the palm tree on the one side, and the face of a young lion toward the palm tree on the other side. They were carved on the whole temple all around. From the floor to above the door, cherubim and palm trees were carved. Similarly, the wall of the nave. The doorposts of the nave were squared, and in front of the holy place was something resembling an altar of wood, 3 cubits high, 2 cubits long, and 2 cubits broad. Its corners, its base, and its walls were of wood. He said to me, "This is the table that is before the Lord." The nave and the holy place had each a double door. The double doors had 2 leaves apiece, 2 swinging leaves for each door. And on the doors of the nave were carved cherubim and palm trees, such as were carved on the walls. And there was a canopy of wood in front of the vestibule outside. And there were narrow windows and palm trees on either side, on the side walls of the vestibule, the side chambers of the temple, and the canopies. Then he led me out into the outer court toward the north, and he brought me to the chambers that were opposite the separate yard and opposite the building on the north. Chapter 42, verse 13. Then he said to me, the north chambers and the south chambers opposite the yard are the holy chambers where the priests who approach the Lord shall eat the most holy offerings. There they shall put the most holy offerings, the grain offering, the sin offering, the guilt offering, for the place is holy. When the priests enter the holy place, they shall not go out of it into the outer court without laying there their garments in which they minister, for these are holy. They shall put on other garments before they go near that which is for the people. Now, when he had finished measuring the interior of the temple area, he led me out by the gate that faced east and measured the temple area all around. He measured the east side with the measuring reed, 500 cubits by the measuring reed all around. He measured the north side, 500 cubits by the measuring reed all around. He measured the south side, 500 cubits by the measuring reed. Then he turned to the west side and measured 500 cubits by the measuring reed. He measured it on four sides. It had a wall around it, 500 cubits long, 500 cubits broad, to make a separation between the holy and the common. The word of the Lord. Has revival broken out yet? Don't worry. Okay, kids, I want all the kids in the room to pay attention here because this time is for you and the grown-ups, right? I know it feels just like grown-up time sometimes, but I want every kid to listen because God cares so much about all of you, and he wants all of you to know how much he loves you and how he wants you to obey him. So have you ever wanted to go to maybe a party or some kind of big fun thing to do, but you weren't allowed to go? Maybe it was a party for somebody and you were too little to go. Or it was going to be too late, so your parents said, no, you can't go, it's going to be too late. Has that ever happened to you? Did you like it when that happened? I remember one time my brother and I wanted to go to a party that my father was having. And we really, really wanted to go, and he said, no, it's going to be too late because it was a New Year's Eve party, and everyone would stay up till midnight. And we said, please, 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 please. He said, nope, 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 you can't go, you'll be too tired. And guess how we thought we would convince him to let us go? We cried really, really hard. And he said, see, you're already too tired. We'd go to your room. And we cried and cried and cried all the more. But he was right. We were too little. Well, we knew this party was going to be so much fun, and we couldn't go. So have you ever felt left out like that? Well, today's Bible verses were very hard to understand. What they were talking about was a picture of how God is going to make a new heaven and new earth someday. And everything's going to be perfect. And finally, we're going to get to see God with our own eyes. You'll actually be able to go walk up to Jesus and climb on his lap and give him a hug. Won't that be so cool? But the only way we get to be a part of that big, wonderful celebration that will last forever is if we trust in Jesus. And he forgives all our sins, he dies for them, and lets us live forever with him. Imagine if we were not allowed to be a part of that big celebration. Wouldn't that be awful? It'd be way worse than being left out of a silly party I was crying about when I was little. All we have to do to be in heaven with Jesus forever is trust in him and say, I need you to die for me, Jesus. And once we believe in him, he'll never, ever let us go. Isn't that great that we know that's what's where we're going to be someday? When we have really tough times right now, when you're sad or you're afraid, you know, this isn't going to last forever. I'm going to be with Jesus forever, with all the other people who trust in him forever. So I want you to think about that during the sermon, but think about it when you're sad or afraid, too, to know that that's where we're all going to be someday. And we ask God to let that day happen soon, right? Okay, think about that during the sermon, all right? Thank you for trying to listen, okay? So, I may have already played my hand here that one of the important things we have to get down before this passage begins to make any sense at all is that this is not a literal earthly temple that is going to be built. Many people miss the great comfort that this passage can bring because they see in it only blueprints that the Jews are going to build in a view that says there's God's kingdom isn't here right now, that it's going to come later on for a literal 1,000 years, some believe. And when that happens, the Jews are going to get their land back in Israel, and they're going to build this unbelievably huge temple and worship in it for a while and enjoy it. And those who aren't Jews still get, I guess, some benefits, but not what they get. And again, we talked last week that Christ's kingdom is not waiting to come. It began when he came to earth and inaugurated it at his first coming. He even says things like, I already bound Satan. That's why I can cast demons out. He is bound. My kingdom is here. And it's not a literal 1,000 years. It's figurative. And it's going to last, going to culminate, I should say, when he returns. And so this passage here is describing for us great comfort, because we know this is not just blueprints that some people get to hang out in the building once it's built. This is a picture of a heavenly reality that's true now, but a picture in the future of what is going to be the case. This is an architectural, theological point. God is using architecture here to make this point. My dwelling place with you in the future is going to blow your mind. It is going to be so powerful, so perfect, so pure. Nothing can possibly ever defile it. Not you, not anything else. It is going to last forever. All my dwelling places in the past with you have been defiled by you. This temple will be absolutely impossible to defile, and it will be your mighty fortress with me forever, and nothing can take it away. That's what's being communicated through all these odd measurements and descriptions of this building. But let me just explain to you a few reasons why I'm not just throwing that out there, because it seems more plausible to me. But again, you lose all the great comfort if you just think this is blueprints that some people get to enjoy at some point. But first, before we get there, it is important that we see why Ezekiel gave us this date in the beginning. Ezekiel often gives us the date of when these visions come, and sometimes we've seen they have some significance. But today's, I think, might be the most important. What we see is this is the exact middle of what would have been a Jubilee cycle. Okay, I'm sure many of you have no idea what I'm talking about. We talked about this a few weeks ago when we talked about God saying, you guys never gave the land the Sabbaths that I demanded you give. You recall God said, yes, they had a weekly Sabbath, but every 7 years they're supposed to have a Sabbath year where they did not work. They did not sow crops, and God was going to provide for them with all this abundance of the previous year so they could just rest, let the land have its rest, but also rest showing their trust that God is their provider. They never did it. But what's worse, seventh Sabbath year, so every 49th to 50th year, was supposed to be the year of Jubilee. So it was not only a Sabbath year again, but anyone who had been forced through financial tough times to sell off their land or even sell themselves and their family into slavery had those debts canceled. Their land was returned to them, and whatever debts that were outstanding were canceled, and they could have their freedom again. It's a beautiful picture of what God is going to do ultimately for the world, where all the debt of sin and everything is canceled, paid for by Christ, and these people are redeemed from their slavery and put back in good standing, settled in their land forever. Well, we're right at year 25 of a Jubilee cycle. And so you see, God is saying, I know what you're yearning for. We've kind of changed position now. We had all this time of my judgment that I was explaining to you, but now we are looking forward to the ultimate Jubilee, when I make all things new, when I cancel all debts, when I redeem all those who've trusted in me, and we dwell settled together. And so I'm going to give you a picture of what you're yearning for in this temple. And so again, this temple is symbolic, not a literal earthly one that's going to be built with these blueprints. What are some of the reasons for that? Well, this language here is very much taken up with, we're going to see some similarities in a minute, with the vision that John sees in Revelation 21. Which is clearly very much otherworldly and heavenly. Okay, so we'll get to some of those similarities in a second. He is also on a great high mountain there, which is far higher than any actual mountain in Jerusalem. Okay, he also associates this temple with the city, with what's going to happen with the whole world. Well, it's going to see next week in Ezekiel 43 that this temple is described as actually covering the world. And we see that in Revelation 21, where he saw a new heavens and a new earth associated with this new Jerusalem that he is building. One interesting point we have to see here is that in Ezekiel 47, we see this beautiful picture of this river gushing forth from under the temple that will flow straight to the Dead Sea and make everything there alive and make the water fresh. Well, there is no river in Jerusalem that is there to be that river in 47. So clearly, again, we're not talking about literal geography. We're talking about theological geography, if I could use that. These things are symbols of theological truths. Jesus said of himself in John 7, I am that living water that flows forth and makes new life. It's not an actual river. It's him. Another crucial piece, remember when Jesus is talking to the woman at the well, and she asks the question, you know, your people say we're supposed to worship at the temple in Jerusalem. My people say it's over here. And Christ says in verse 21 of John 4, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we do know. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and in truth. So some future visions in Ezekiel describe this temple area where all the nations are going to gather to worship him. But Christ said flat out, we're not going to worship in Jerusalem in the future. So if this is all about a literal place where we're all going to finally gather, it's at odds with Christ's words. But one very important thing, in all these temple visions and descriptions, we get language of here's where the sacrifices will happen, here's where the priests will conduct the sacrificial things, here's where these atoning sacrifices will happen. Does that sound problematic to any of you? That when the Lord returns, all of a sudden animal sacrifice is resumed for the purpose of atonement? I hope that sounds horrible to you, because how could that ever happen again? Hebrews 10 flat out says so in verse 8. The author says this, when he said, you have neither desired nor taken pleasure in sacrifices and offerings and burnt offerings and sin offerings. Then he added, behold, I have come to do your will. He does away with the first to establish the second. And by that will, we have been sanctified through the offering of the body of Jesus Christ once for all. And every priest stands daily at his service, offering repeatedly the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But when Christ had offered for all time a single sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God, waiting from that time until his enemies should be made a footstool for his feet. For by a single offering, he has perfected for all time those who are being sanctified. If that's what Christ's work has accomplished, which it has, how dare anyone say we need to take up sacrifices again in the future? Because it was clearly done once for all time. So this temple is a picture of what Christ is doing to atone for his people and how we are able to dwell with him. But it is not an actual temple that's going to be built with sacrifices that will resume again. And there are many Christians who teach that, and they need to reckon with this, because that is an affront to the finished work of Christ to ever say again that atoning sacrifices would have to happen. So if you want to turn to Revelation 21, we'll get a little bit of light shed on what is going on with some of this imagery. Some real similarities should jump out at you here. Revelation 21, verse 1, John says this, then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, New Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned for her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people. And God himself will be with them as their God. Jump ahead to verse 10. And he carried me away in the spirit to a great high mountain. And he showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God. Jump to verse 15. And the one who spoke with me had a measuring rod of gold to measure the city and its gates and its walls. All right, so you see, very similar kind of vision here. This is depicting, but enlarging on the same kind of thing that Ezekiel saw. They're foretelling the same event. This is about how God dwells with his people, it says. And so if that's the case, why all these architectural details? I mean, you'll notice I skipped a lot. And even what I read might have sounded overbearing. Okay. What's the point? Well, again, God is giving a sign to weak people. People who have been lamenting, as we saw in the Psalms, what? How can we sing the Psalms of Zion in a foreign land. To them, I don't have access to God if I don't have a temple. Even though God has encouraged them through Ezekiel saying, but I make my dwelling, or I tabernacle with you. I brought my throne to you in Babylon. Take heart. I'm not bound to live in temples made by man. But these weak souls struggle with that concept. And so God comes to them in their weakness and says, okay, guys, you want access to me? You are languishing here in captivity, wanting to know if you're ever going to have joy again, and you think that getting to me requires a temple? Check this out. This temple I'm making for you is so big, it's the size of Jerusalem. And its foundations and its gates and its walls are so imposing and so perfectly designed. You will have access to me like you never imagined. So you remember back in chapter 11, God did a similar thing. He took Ezekiel in a vision all the way to Jerusalem. But he foretold there its destruction. And he had a similar angelic figure as we have here, but he had a writing case taking down what was going to happen. But now we have an angelic figure doing the exact opposite. All that destruction and God saying, my presence is leaving you, is being undone. And now God is foretelling just how richly he's going to dwell with his people. The kind of amazing access they're going to have to his favor and his throne. Because now they feel like there's no access possible because of their sin. So what do all these details mean? Again, we can only go through a select few. And I want you to notice all the measuring language. I'm sure it was hard to miss. Okay. This figure there with these measuring tools, and everything is being measured. And you wonder, like, couldn't God have just told without having to measure it? Couldn't he have just told Ezekiel? By the way, Ezekiel, here are the dimensions. 500 cubits, 500 cubits, 500 cubits, 500. 100, 100, 100. But the measuring process is what is being brought home each time. And that's a common image that God uses throughout the Old Testament, often for assessment. People can have the measuring line that's talking about destruction that's coming. Or God often foretells a measuring line is in his hand because he's going to rebuild something, and he's assessing this process. This temple, this dwelling place, is shown to be assessed by God. He's measuring it and showing it to be absolutely perfect. If you notice, there was lots of crazy symmetry. Like, unbelievable details about how symmetrical everything is. Particularly, everything is square. And the closer you get into the holy place, the more perfectly square things you see, even cubes. Again, to the mind there, that absolute precision, perfect square, is this idea of theological perfection being demonstrated by the construction of the building. Many authors talk about this idea of grades of holiness in the picture of this temple. If you notice, we start on the outside and we move in closer and closer through different rooms and chambers and gates and vestibules. Okay? We're getting closer and closer to the heart of this holiness. And if you notice, as we get there, I had to skip a lot of this. As we're moving into the temple, you're kind of on a tour. And the closer you get to the inner courts, the more steps you have to go up. Things are getting higher. And also the passages are getting narrower. Again, depicting with architecture absolute perfection in God. He is far away from all that is unholy. He is higher than we are. And the way to him is narrow because you cannot pass through unless you are perfect. All that is being depicted. This is the most perfectly designed picture of dwelling with God. You'll notice, again, when you're reading it, the walls are absurdly thick for a temple structure. They're more like city walls. They're 10 feet thick. And, of course, because it's got to be symmetrical, they're 10 feet high. And it's a perfect square around the entire structure. You'll notice that the gatehouses that are built here are given very complete descriptions. And they're mammoth. Again, almost absurd for a temple structure. It's more like you'd find to protect a massive city. Again, associating this temple with the city, with the world, this picture of how God's dealing with his people. But what you see here is being emphasized by these very, very thick gates and imposing gatehouses. thick walls and imposing gatehouses is this. First of all, as it came around to the very end of the section, it said, this is separating the holy from the common. Some of your translations may have said from the profane. What is permitted in here is what I have set aside and I have made pure. Anything that has not been put in that category may not enter. You also see with the gates, not only is it separating it from all that is unholy or common, but these gates make it evident you will not enter by your own choice. You will not decide to come in here unless God permits you to enter. Many discuss the fact that there's only entries on the front and the sides and none in the rear because you cannot sneak up on God and get in your way. You will enter if he permits you to enter. And these gatehouses make that very clear. You also notice that the text went out of its way to talk about, as we were getting into the holy place, how many images of cherubim and palm trees were carved on just about everything. Now, some of that is common to the ancient Near East. You would see these carvings, cherubim or angelic figures, not necessarily cherubim, and palm trees. It's an association with abundant life and royal power and things like that. But here, this is something that God had designed on the first temple as well. Cherubim and palm trees. And it's very much a hearkening back to the very first temple God ever established with man, the Garden of Eden. And palm trees are hearkening back to that because it was, again, a picture of abundant life. But the cherubim there are almost always in Scripture God's guardians. Again, please get out of your mind any kind of chubby, rosy-cheeked cherub with little fluffy wings on its back, okay? The cherubim would have been the kind of thing that just evoke horror. That's why when everyone sees a cherubim, they fall flat on their face, begging not to be killed. And we've seen cherubim show up very often in Ezekiel. You recall, they were the ones carrying this mobile throne of God, back then all having four faces, and absolutely mortifying Ezekiel in fear. He couldn't talk for a week. That is a picture not of, oh, isn't that angel cute? It's a picture of the cherubim are the throne bearers of God. And if you want to get to God, you have to get past them. And just as the abundant life of the Garden of Eden was shut off to us once we fell, it was guarded by a cherubim with a flaming sword. And whenever they show up, it is a devastating thing in many ways. It's a reminder, you are cut off from God. Because only the perfectly pure can dwell with him. So there they are again on God's throne, the Ark of the Covenant, which was given us with us with what instructions? Touch this and die. The cherubim with a reminder, don't. You cannot have access to God if you're impure. And they're on the veil of the Holy of Holies, keeping anyone out. Reminder, if you cross this veil, the cherubim remind you, you will die. And so this dwelling place of God in this holy place is very powerfully stating, only the pure are permitted here because this is God's dwelling place and they would die if they tried to enter. So it's very clear, as the summary verse says at the end, all this architecture is about separating the holy, keeping it pure from all that is impure, from all that is common or profane. So it's very clear. This temple, the architecture preaches to us, will never be defiled. And that's a message the people of God need to hear because all they have done up to this point is defile God's temples. The first dwelling place, again, the first dwelling place of God, the first place of access to God in Eden. What does Adam do? He was commissioned to guard it. It's a better translation than cultivate. Guard and keep it. But he permits Satan to enter, sits there and lets him speak, lets him deceive his wife, and then decides to follow his advice and turn on God, committing high treason. So the garden has been defiled, and the defilers are cast out. And then when God made the tabernacle to dwell with his people, yes, it's a flimsy tent, but God is dwelling there. But these priests begin to defile it right away. Aaron's sons, Nadab and Abihu, offering some sort of blasphemous unauthorized rituals before God, and they're put to death. And then Eli's sons, Hophni and Phinehas, using it for all sorts of horrifying immorality, and they are cast out. The very priests are supposed to be conducting the worship of God, defiling his place. And then God builds an actual temple, beautiful by earthly standards, powerful and imposing. And as we kind of began in the series of Ezekiel, by the time they are put into captivity, they have done as Adam did. They tolerated foreign gods. They gave them a place. And then began to actually worship these foreign gods with their horrifying, immoral rituals right in the very space of the temple and defiled it. So God cast them out like they were cast out of Eden into exile, east to Babylon. So this temple, God says, will never be defiled. So how in the world are any of us going to get in? Why is a message like this hopeful to exiles who are there because of their sin to hear that, don't worry, sinners, no sinners will be allowed in this one? It's the anxious cry, in many ways, of Psalm 24 that we went over last summer, where the psalmist says, who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Who may dwell in his holy place? Meaning, who has access to the dwelling place of God? And he puts the standards out there very clearly. He who has clean hands and a pure heart, who does not lift up his soul to an idol or swear by what is false. Who may ascend the hill of the Lord? Whoever has their act together. Whoever doesn't sin. If you want access to God, great. Don't sin and he'll let you in. And there's that break there in the middle. You're kind of thinking, well, then who's ever going to ascend the hill of the Lord? And then with the imagined trumpet blast in the background as someone is returning from battle, you hear, lift up the gates, open them up. And somebody's going up the hill. You think, who? That's what the psalm keeps asking. Who? Who made it up the hill? Who had clean hands and a pure heart? And the psalm says, the Lord, strong and mighty, the Lord mighty in battle. He has ascended the hill of the Lord. So open those gates, and how dare you keep him out? And that is why the only reason we have any hope of entering this perfect temple that will never be defiled by sin is because, as we see later on in Revelation 21, Christ is this temple. He said so when he was on earth numerous times. But if you turn to Revelation 21, verse 22, look how glorious these words are as we see just how much access we actually have to enter this undefilable temple of God. Revelation 21, 22, and I saw no temple in the city. Recall this New Jerusalem he was describing before? I saw no temple in the city, for its temple is the Lord God, the Almighty and the Lamb. And the city has no need of sun or moon to shine in it. For the glory of God gives it light, and its lamp is the Lamb. By its light will the nations walk, and the kings of the earth will bring their glory into it. And its gates will never be shut by day, and there will be no night there. They will bring into it the glory and honor of the nations. But nothing unclean will ever enter it, nor anyone who does what is detestable or false, but only those who are written in the Lamb's book of life. And that's us. Because for us, the cherubim have been relieved from duty. When that curtain tore once and for all, we had access, and we have it now. We don't get to see him face to face. And this temple, this vision is telling us, you will have more access than you can imagine. He's coming to you to put his spirit in you now so that he's the stamp sealing you forever. But someday, heaven is coming to earth to make it new. And we will have absolute face-to-face access with Christ, our King, who is our temple. And one glorious feature of this temple, one aspect of the thickness of its walls that many scholars point out, it doesn't just keep out what is holy, what is unholy. It also keeps what is inside secure forever. So we will finally be those who can't defile it. We will be those who will never be able to be cast out, because he has brought us there in Christ. As we ascend the hill, because he ascended, we are allowed access to this temple because he is the temple. Because we are covered by his perfect righteousness and given credit for dying the death he died. And because we have the new life in us that he won for us when he rose again and defeated sin and death, access to this temple is absolutely guaranteed. More sure than anything this world can guarantee for us. And so in the midst of our painful exile, as we wait our chance to finally see him face to face, as we realize this world is not our home, and we know this world can never fully meet the longings that we have, we are reminded that our home is when heaven and earth become one, when we see him face to face. And we are reminded here, because he is that temple and we are united to him, nothing will keep us out of that perfect joy forever.